v. Wari. Mr. Garcia.
Good morning. May it please the Court. The District Court's denial of absolute immunity in this case for the alleged conduct of the defendant assistant state attorneys in procuring testimony from witnesses for his retrial not only was contrary to the Supreme Court's decision in Imbler v. Packman, but raises important issues about the policy underlying absolute immunity, and particularly as it pertains to the function of an office.
Preliminary question. So Kelly got, or did they both get qualified immunity?
For certain aspects. It's kind of messy the way the opinion is left. Kelly got qualified immunity for the alleged fabrication of the witness's testimony.
Well, is there any other issue involving Kelly?
Well, the state law claims are pending, and that's why this is important.
I understand. That's that. But is there any federal claim against Kelly that hasn't been wiped out by the qualified immunity?
Oh, Your Honor.
And with regard to Wari,
they let
qualified immunity for the his activities when he wasn't on the trial team?
No, Your Honor. That's the claim that Judge Cannelli left standing, is with respect to the suppression claim with respect to the witness's testimony for the retrial.
Right. So
that's the federal.
That's
really the
one. The live issue.
That's the one live federal question.
Sure.
ASA Wari. It gets confusing because of the overlap of qualified immunity and absolute immunity, and how the state law claims got left standing because of the question the trial court had.
But I mean, there's nothing really we have to decide with respect to Kelly.
Well, the state law claims are still
pending. Well, the state law,
as to the federal claims, but our argument would be that absolute immunity applies to all the claims against him, including the state law claims. So as a practical matter, the extent that...
That was never decided. The state law immunity question, apart from sovereign immunity, was not decided.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we don't have that in this case.
It's not before Your Honor directly, but as we pointed out in our brief, the parties all agree that absolute immunity applies to state law claims. The applicability of the immunity is coextensive with federal law, and the plaintiffs agree to that. So to the extent that you find that ASA Kelly would be absolutely immune from the claims against him, that would apply to the state law claims as well and would remove the state law claims as to ASA Kelly.
But you don't think we have any business with the state law claims?
That would be for the applicability of sovereign immunity. That's correct, Your Honor.
We can't announce absolute immunity under state law if we don't have jurisdiction over the state claims.
It comes as a sort of alternate argument, but in either case, there would be immunity one way or the other.
But the point is that as to prosecutorial immunity as opposed to sovereign immunity, we don't have any question pertaining to Kelly as a defendant in this appeal. All we have is a prosecutorial immunity question with respect to that one claim having to do with Wari as a defendant. I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
Wari. That would be correct.
So that's the only live issue on prosecutorial immunity that we have here, and then we have the sovereign immunity issues.
That's correct.
Okay. I think we've clarified that.
Well, with respect to the live remaining claim, then, given that the underlying conduct was directly related to procurement of trial testimony, it clearly falls within the Supreme Court's decision in Imbler. And what happened, the plaintiff wanted to argue that it was investigative because it occurred at a time when ASA Kelly might not have technically been assigned to a trial or to the retrial, even though he actually did try the second case. But what the district court relied on was the plaintiff's argument that under this court's previous decision in Houston versus Partee, because he was not personally attached to a trial team at the time that he had this interaction with the witness, that therefore he was not acting in a prosecutorial capacity or in his official quote-unquote role as a prosecutor, and therefore was not entitled to prosecutorial immunity.
The chronology is that this conduct took place while the direct appeal was still pending, or the post-conviction motion was pending in the state appellate court?
It's not exactly clear from the complaint. For instance, the plaintiff alleges this ASA worry that immediately after his conviction, but while his direct appeal was pending, he attempted to procure the witness testimony for the retrial, which, of course, there would not have been a retrial at that time. ASA Kelly, he very specifically alleges that nothing alleged as to him occurred prior to 1998. So that would,
after
in a sense, be
post-conviction relief had been granted but was still being appealed, apparently?
Well, after the post-conviction relief is granted, then it goes back for a new trial, which is why we argued that clearly there was a pending prosecution during this entire time. The prosecution just didn't end. You either have the conviction or you have the direct appeal, in which the conviction was affirmed. Then you have his post-conviction appeal. Well, he's still convicted at that time until his conviction is set aside, but then the retrial is down the road from there. So the prosecution is still pending during the entire time.
So Houston isn't distinguishable, is it?
Well, we in fact argue that Imbler directly applies, since the alleged conduct, the underlying prosecutorial conduct that's the basis of the claims, is directly related to the retrial. So therefore, Imbler should apply directly. What the trial court did is said, well, because he wasn't, I guess the distinction is that the focus became no longer on the underlying prosecutorial function of the conduct, but became on the fact that the prosecutor individually was somehow no longer associated with the judicial process or was not associated with the judicial
process. Isn't Imbler earlier than Houston?
Absolutely. Imbler was the seminal Supreme Court case.
So you're saying Houston is wrong.
That's what I'm saying, Judge. Based upon the Supreme Court's discussion of Imbler in Vandekamp, which occurred.
What is it in Imbler that you think is inconsistent with Houston?
Nothing in Imbler is inconsistent with Houston. Houston is inconsistent with Imbler. And that's what the Supreme Court explained.
If Houston is inconsistent with Imbler, Imbler is inconsistent with Houston.
Well, I guess I'm looking at it from the point of view that the Supreme Court opinion controls, and therefore...
Of course it does. I'm just asking you, what is the inconsistency between Imbler and Houston?
The inconsistency is that in Imbler, as the court explained in Vandekamp, the prosecutorial immunity would apply to all of the prosecutors. They said you don't look at the patterns of liability within the office, within an office of prosecutors. And that's why the Supreme Court in Vandekamp said, suppose the plaintiff in Vandekamp had sued not the supervisors, because that case directly involved a claim against supervisors and the implementation of a policy or procedure to get the GLIO information to the plaintiff. But said, suppose that plaintiff had sued the trial attorney or his colleagues.
What if you had what if you have a prosecutor? He's in the prosecutor's office. He's in the U.S. attorney's office or something, or state attorney's office. He has absolutely nothing to do with the case. In fact, he doesn't have anything to do with the whole division that handles cases of this sort. But he has some personal dislike of the defendant. So he offers his 2 cents worth and tries to frame the defendant and so on. You think the fact that he's employed by the prosecutor gives him absolute immunity?
I think the fact that he's a prosecutor in the office...
Answer my question.
Answering your question, Your Honor.
No,
the
question is a yes or no question.
The answer is yes. Because he's employed at the office...
Well, I don't agree with you at all. That can't be right. Just the fact of being employed gives absolute immunity to everything you do?
Not everything you do, Your Honor. No. The question, and as pertains to this case,
right,
is...
What doesn't it
involves,
extend to?
Where the plaintiff's claim involves a trial-related claim, in this case, procurement of witness testimony and the suppression of information about that, where there's a trial-related claim, the other prosecutors in the office are entitled to absolute immunity, and that's exactly what Vandekamp says.
Well, I don't agree with that. Look, suppose you have a bunch of prosecutors, state's attorney's office is huge, mm-hmm. and you have one person, he's absolutely nothing to do with these cases. He is a prosecutor. The defendant is a personal enemy, so he creates fraudulent evidence, which he feeds to the prosecutor who is actually prosecuting the case. He says, look, I found this great stuff. You'll be really interested in this. I know I have nothing to do with this case. I'm in a different division. I just happened to find it, and I'm giving it to you as a present. That's absolute immunity?
That's, yes, Judge. Because...
Where is that in Van Kemp?
Absolute immunity applies...
Where is that in Van Kemp?
In Van Kemp did not discuss the factual scenario exactly that you're talking about, where some prosecutor...
So what is it in Van Kemp that you...
Van Kemp says...
...extract as a rule that would govern my case?
Well, particularly where Van Kemp talks about, for instance... It doesn't think the fact that you're talking about general office practices. What happened at Vandekamp was we were getting away from the trial. In fact, the supervisors would not have known or would not have been connected to the trial, but also talked about other colleagues within the office knowing about the alleged impeachment evidence that was not given to the plaintiff in this trial. The Vandekamp court said all of these people would be immune, and they're not interested in the fact that you're talking about general office procedures, for instance, with respect to supervisors.
I thought what was important in Van Kemp was the statement that a claim about faulty training against the supervisory employee, you know, failure to train prosecutors properly, that claim rests in necessary part upon a consequent error by an individual prosecutor in the midst of the trial.
Absolutely.
Someone who's responsible for training, right, is going to his responsibilities. They're at one remove from the actual trial,
right,
but they're very much related to the trial. That's his duty. But in my hypothetical case, the prosecutor has absolutely no assignment to the case, relation to the case, anything.
Right.
Just volunteers some evidence.
And in Van de Kemp,
he's not acting within the scope of his duties, but Van de Kemp was acting within the scope of his duties.
Well, but let's step back for a moment. In Van de Kemp, the court said, well, let's tell you how we get to our decision. And it's in Part 3A of their opinion where they discuss Imbler and the applicability of Imbler, that that's what I'm concentrating on. Where they say, and in this case, the plaintiff alleged that other prosecutors in the office knew about the underlying facts involved in an informant, a jailhouse informant whose testimony had been used in other cases. So it's very similar to the facts here, where you have different witnesses involved in the El Rukin prosecutions, and as Houston points out, Mr. Summers was presented different times.
I just see a discussion of this supervisor. You're saying the opinion...
Under Part 3A. It's page 862 of the... Part 3A of the opinion, at page 862, where they say...
Part 3, okay. Yeah. And what do they say?
Let's go back and talk about Imbler, the court says, and we'll tell you how the intermediate step we take to get where we're at in Van de Kemp. And they say, look, under Imbler, look at the facts in our case here, and if the plaintiff had brought the case not against the supervisors, but against the trial attorney himself or his colleagues, and remember, in this case, plaintiff alleged that other attorneys in the office knew about this information, and that's the information that was not given to him in his trial. They said, well, we don't think you pay attention to the patterns of liability, although you know, perhaps the trial attorney or the colleagues could be liable as well.
What makes you think he's talking about colleagues that have nothing to do with the prosecution?
Based on the plaintiff's allegations in the case itself, where other people in the office knew about this information. The allegations were there was jailhouse informant had been used in a number of cases. So this was information in the office known to other prosecutors. And his claim specifically in this case was that the district attorney, or as we call it here, the state's attorney, had not developed procedures to sort of corral that information to provide it where it was appropriate. Again, very similar to this case.
This is about indictment or trial prosecution. I'm reading from Justice Breyer's opinion in your Part 3. Decisions about indictment or trial prosecution will often involve more than one prosecutor within an office. Well, that's fine. But what does that have to do with someone who is not involved in the prosecution, although he happens to be employed there?
What directly implicates what the court is talking about, the importance...
Where is he talking about those people? I don't see anything about colleagues who are not involved in the prosecution.
That's on page 862. That's exactly what they're talking about. He says this his colleague. If he had sued...
Where is he talking about... Tell me where he's talking about colleagues not involved in the prosecution.
It's part of the example explaining Imbler when he says, what if the plaintiff had sued the trial attorney or his colleagues... So yes, not the, so
but he doesn't implicit, say they're colleagues that aren't involved in the prosecution.
I respectfully disagree, Judge. I think that's exactly what he's talking about. Given
how
the
how can you say that?
Because in the underlying case, the plaintiff alleged that other prosecutors in the office knew, so that's the only people he could be referring to by his colleagues, by saying, well, so I distinguish the trial attorney.
He's describing this as a hypothetical case.
To explain Imbler as their precursor to describe how they got to the more general claims in Vandekamp, because in Vandekamp, the district attorney clearly had nothing to do with the trial itself, and they make that clear. But
there's nothing in this discussion to suggest that he's talking about colleagues who have nothing to do with a specific prosecution.
Well, then it would make sense for the court to talk about patterns of liability among people in an office if he's only talking about the trial attorneys.
Because what he's saying is you have one prosecutor who's, you know, in charge or something, but he's working with other people, the supervisor, which is the real focus of the case, and colleagues.
Mr. Garcia, is it your position that a prosecutor's office, regardless of size, on any investigation, is entitled to absolute immunity, save criminal conduct by an assistant? As Judge Posner had posited something to you before, it sounded like perhaps the conduct of a prosecutor was criminal.
Well, what we're talking about here is Section 983 liability, so I don't think absolute prosecutable immunity applies to criminal conduct at all. That's clearly not the case.
Right.
What we're talking about here is trial-related claims brought by the individual plaintiff in a 1983 case.
I understand. I just want to cabin your argument on absolute immunity so that I understand where you believe it doesn't apply.
As we're talking here, it would apply to the trial-related claim brought by a plaintiff, where the prosecutorial function implicated is a trial-based claim, and that's what Vandekamp was talking about. And in this case, procurement of witness for trial, or witness testimony for trial, and the alleged suppression of the circumstances surrounding the acquisition of that testimony. In this case, there's different allegations, but I think the standing claim is that he was offered cooperation in return for his own case, which is something that happens in offices all the time. And that's why it's important to note that the Vandekamp Court's concentration on the function of the office as a whole. And that's why I think, to answer your question, Judge Posner, the court was talking about other colleagues in the office, because that's their point here, is it's the function of the office as a whole. You're often going to have different witnesses.
Federal assistant U.S. attorney in Arizona sent some kind of fraudulent letter to prosecutors in Chicago. Because this Arizona prosecutor had some personal animus against a defendant that he'd read about in Chicago, would he be a colleague?
To answer your question, no, I don't think so, because I think what Vandekamp was talking about,
because he's in a different office.
Correct, a different prosecuting
That's
authority.
Absurd.
I don't because think so, Your Honor.
How many assistant U.S. attorneys are there in Chicago?
I don't know about U.S. attorneys. I can tell you in the state's attorney's office, there's approximately 800.
Well, I think there are more in the assistant U.S. attorney's office. In the U.S. attorney's office, 100 people in different offices, they're all colleagues? So what about the Justice Department in Washington, right? The antitrust division that we just heard from. So they're all colleagues, too?
Well, we're focusing.
It doesn't matter the size of the office, as long as it's in one build. That seems to be important to you. You don't want to have the Arizona person given the absolute immunity. So, as long as they're in one building.
No, Judge, that's not the distinction I'm making. The distinction is the Arizona prosecutor is a different prosecuting authority. What we're talking about here is an office.
They're all part of the Justice Department.
Well, that's. But no,
that's a single prosecuting authority.
The single prosecuting authority that I'm talking about is, in this case, the state's attorney. And it's the interest of the state of Illinois, in prosecuting the case. That's
the attorney have just one office?
No, of course not.
Well, what if someone in the Peoria office is interfering with some prosecution in Chicago? Is he a colleague?
Well,
is he a colleague or not?
He would be a colleague.
Is he a colleague in your Imbler interpretation?
It would depend
entitled
on what,
to I, absolute immunity.
I can't answer the question without...
Yes, you can.
I would have to understand what you mean by interference.
Oh, come on.
No, Judge.
Look, suppose the person in the state's attorney's office in Peoria writes a letter to a prosecutor in Chicago, a forged letter accusing some personal enemy of this lawyer, of this prosecutor in Peoria, of criminal activity for which he's being prosecuted in Chicago. Now, is he a colleague entitled to absolute immunity?
No.
Why not?
Because he's not in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. What we're talking about is...
No, he's part of the State's Attorney. He is in the State's Attorney's Office. He's in a different physical locale. Is that the critical difference?
The physical locale is not the critical difference.
What is the critical difference? He's an employee of the State's Attorney. Just
No, he's not. He's not, Judge, because the State's Attorney... In Illinois, each State's Attorney is an elected constitutional...
Mean there are different state's attorneys?
There are different...
Well, all right, then the state attorney general, he must have field offices.
In that case, then, I would say, yes, they were a colleague. The distinction I'm making is, and what I think Vannikin was focusing on...
Does the distinction have some purpose?
Yes, it does, Judge.
Some rationale?
What the Vannikin court is looking at is the interest in the office, which is the state's attorney. The state's attorney obviously has different people...
See what has anything to do with any...
Well,
differences.
I say I'm out of time. I don't want to. If I may have one thought to.
All right, I've harassed you enough.
Well, I just want to answer
one
simple follow-up. That is the point, and I think the importance of looking at the function of the office as a whole is something like in this case, and where Houston also shows, where you're dealing with a large number of prosecutions that are interrelated. The whole idea is to protect the office and its interest in prosecuting crime by having all the attorneys in the office who may be assigned, and it recognizes the modern prosecutor's office, where you may have different people assigned to a single prosecution at a different phase or stage, appeal, trial, or you may have people come and go.
Why don't you argue the policy behind it?
Well, this is the policy.
The policy is that there's a cost-attendant immunity, absolute immunity, right?
Well,
and you're
absolutely
suggesting that it's worth it. Isn't that your argument?
And that's exactly what the court said. Starting with Imbler, that's we have the trade-off, the balance, and the whole point is to support the function.
So that you have a situation in a single office where a person who shouldn't be in the office, as using the example Judge Posner, we have to assume that he gets the umbrella of protection under your argument, right? Simply because you hope that is a rare incident. Isn't that what absolute immunity for a prosecutor is all about?
Absolutely. I think Imbler said it's not to protect the easy cases. It's because the easy cases bring the difficult cases behind them. And that's just the point where we recognize that some people don't
receive
compensation.
Well, it helps to emphasize what the policy is sometimes, as well as the specific case law.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Garcia.
You,
Mr. Goodman?
May it please the court. Counsel. I represent Nathan Fields, and Mr. Fields' complaint alleges that he spent 18 years in prison, much of it on death row, due in part to misconduct of two state prosecutors. And as the court has correctly identified, this case really involves a claim against one particular prosecutor, Mr. Waring. And that claim is that after trial, while Mr. Fields is sitting on death row, after Mr. Wary's role in the prosecution had ended, and while Mr. Fields' case is beginning to come unraveled, Mr. Wary then fabricated evidence from an Al Rukin hitman named Earl Hawkins, who had, according to the government, had committed more than a dozen murders and had been identified as a shooter in the case at issue here. The government made an arrangement with him to give false testimony. Mr. Wary made an arrangement with Mr. Hawkins to give false testimony against Mr. Fields. And as the lower court found, Mr. Wherry was not absolutely immune for this conduct. And the court relied on Supreme Court law, the Buckley case, Buckley 3, and also on, although the court did find that Mr. Wherry had qualified immunity for the fabrication of evidence under Buckley 4, which is an opinion of this court. However, the court found that one claim did survive, and that was the claim involving the concealment of exculpatory evidence relating to Mr. Earl Hawkins. That claim does survive, and the court relied on Houston v. Partee, a decision of this case, this court. And that case is quite similar on its facts. It involved the same prosecutor, Mr. Wherry, and involved some of the same witnesses, Al-Rukin witnesses. And in that case, Mr. Wherry had prosecuted Mr. Houston for a murder that he didn't commit. After trial and after Mr. Wherry's official role in the prosecution had ended, the case began to unravel. A witness named Anthony Sumner admitted that Mr. Houston was not the shooter, was not involved, and subsequent to that, other witnesses came forward and gave similar confirmation that Mr. Houston was not involved. Mr. Wherry suppressed, the allegation was that Mr. Wherry suppressed that exculpatory evidence, and Mr. Houston sat in prison. This court found that the prosecutor was not entitled to absolute immunity. The court said that the prosecutor's knowledge of and failure to disclose Sumner's original statements and the three subsequent statements had no connection to his role as an advocate for the state. Now, the state is arguing here that Houston is no longer good law after Vandekamp. And our position is that that is incorrect for three reasons. First of all, we argue that it's waived because it was not fully presented to Judge Kennelly. Judge Kennelly actually never looked at that question because it was raised in a reply memorandum. Secondly, even if it's not waived or forfeited, the claim, the Vandekamp case, as Judge Posner has correctly pointed out, is a case exclusively involving supervision and training claims in the office. And the court looked at Imbler and talked about the harm that they were worried about in Imbler of disrupting an office and making it hard for honest prosecutors to do their job. And the Supreme Court said that these types of claims, that there's absolute immunity. And the court specifically looked at the anomaly of the situation where a trial prosecutor would be immune, even for intentionally and failing to turn over Giglio material, but her supervisor or trainer would be liable for negligent training or supervision. And the court said that that can't be.
The same anomaly obtains here. And so the rationale of that case does undermine Houston, it seems to me, because it talks about it goes back to the idea that these immunity questions relate to the function being performed and not specifically who is performing it, right? I mean, that's the rationale underlying absolute immunity, is that this prosecutorial function is what's being protected, not the specific conduct in question. And it seems to me that the Houston decision put sort of a temporal and case prosecutor-specific boundary on that Vandekamp doesn't allow. The fact pattern in Vandekamp was that a bunch of people in the L.A. DA's office knew about the Giglio information and didn't turn it over. The defendants in that case were the supervisors, but the rationale of Justice Breyer's opinion applies equally to everybody in the office who had that knowledge and didn't disclose. I mean, that's the whole point of the hypothetical that we've been discussing here today. And it seems to me that that discussion in the case undermines this court's decision in Houston to the extent that it removes that immunity from a prosecutor after the trial is over, but all of these post-conviction proceedings are still pending. So the case is still very much alive and the prosecutors are working it. Even though he's not on the appellate team, he's still working the case as a prosecutor.
He was not on the retrial team either. His role in the case had ended.
He's still working the case as a prosecutor, even though he's committing all of these wrongs.
First of all, I guess I don't read Van de Kamp that broadly. I don't think that what the court is saying is that anyone in the office that had nothing to do with training with respect to this particular case.
What he's specifically saying is that anybody who had knowledge of the Giglio information and didn't turn it over is immune. That's what the import of the hypothetical is.
My understanding.
Not just these supervisors, but the colleagues as well who had this knowledge and didn't turn it over. The immunity attaches to anybody who's performing a prosecutorial function, whether it's someone who's actually the line prosecutor in charge of the case or a supervisor or a colleague and has the information and doesn't turn it over, has immunity for that misconduct.
Right, if they're
involved. In the same way where he has... No. The prosecutors who had the Giglio information, it didn't matter whether they were the actual case prosecutor. If they had the information and didn't turn it over, they were immune for that misconduct, according to the case.
I understand that, but I think that they were part of the prosecutorial function because they were involved in training the line prosecutors. I don't think the court, because the court specifically says, we conclude that petitioners are entitled to absolute immunity in respect to claims that their supervision, training, or information system management was constitutionally inadequate.
Right. That was the holding of the case, but the rationale applies much more broadly and does undermine Houston's attempt to sort of find a boundary around the immunity based on the prosecutor's case-related functions having ended at the trial, even though the case continues.
Well, I do think there's a difference, because I think that in Van de Kamp you're talking about people that come into contact with particular Giglio information because of their role as training or supervising
but
the line prosecutors.
That whole section of the case is not just dealing with the supervisors. It's dealing with colleagues with the Giglio information who failed to disclose. And this may be colleagues who were on the case or colleagues who were off the case.
Let me frame it, if I could, another way. Prosecutor A prosecutes first trial, case is reversed on appeal, and he's not part of the retrial. There is a retrial. Prosecutor B says, I'm in charge, you're not on the case anymore, but it comes to A and says, you know, you had a relationship with this witness in that first case. You're not going to join the team, but I'm going to use you and Inspector C to go talk to that person. And that report back isn't as accurate as it should be. Let's say it involves the kind of conduct charged in this case. Is absolute immunity denied that Prosecutor A, even though he's under the umbrella of the second case because he's acting with the state's attorney's investigator as...
I would say that no, that person would, because that person is, whether he's officially a member of the team or not, mm-hmm. he's a de facto member of the team. They're using his as a resource. And I think that goes to the fact that the office has an interest. This person is acting in the interest of the state's attorney's office. He's assisting the team. There is no evidence here that Mr. Wary was acting on behalf of the prosecution team. It would be our contention that he's acting in his own interest because the case had begun to unravel.
Well,
he had put on fabricated...
What was his interest?
His interest...
Not a malevolent now, but what is his own... Was it to protect or to justify the initial prosecution? Would you say that was his interest?
I would say to prevent the misconduct that he committed, which he's immune for in connection with the original prosecution,
right,
from being exposed, either through a subsequent prosecution, through a civil rights case, and that's exactly what this court talked about in Houston. There's another case that we cited in our brief that had a similar situation where the allegation was specifically that the prosecutor was motivated to cover up his own misconduct at the first trial, and therefore he went back to witnesses who he had coerced to give false testimony and told them to threaten them in order to get them to stick with their story. And that's the case, Spurlock v. Thompson out of the Sixth Circuit. There's no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman.
Thank you.
Garcia, your time expired, but you have another minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. A lot of what counsel was talking about was that he had some personal interest or motive. Motive doesn't play into absolute immunity. Once the conduct, the underlying conduct itself is found to be immune, that's the end of the inquiry. The case that counsel brought up, Spurlock, I think we distinguished in our reply brief, where it wasn't in relation to the underlying criminal prosecution or any stage of that in the office. It was in relation to independent administrative proceedings somewhere else that the prosecutor tried to coerce the testimony. In this case, we're talking about everything having to do with the case itself. In fact,
how is that line to be drawn? How do we know whether it's a cover-up and therefore outside of immunity or more case-related activity?
The question, I don't think, Your Honor, would be whether it's a cover-up or motive-related type of question. The issue, I think, the bright line is that it was not in relation to the criminal prosecution. So, therefore, even under Imbler, it wouldn't be considered prosecutorial conduct or an underlying prosecutorial function in connection with the criminal prosecution. It had to do with something else. So, under Imbler on its own, putting aside any distinctions with Houston seemed to be drawing a distinction whether the individual within the office was personally somehow functionally tied to the prosecution. And the question, and where Van de Kamp said, is we look at the function itself, the prosecutorial function. In this case, we're talking about the procurement of witness testimony.
So isn't the logic of your position that in my earlier example that the assistant U.S. attorney in Arizona would have immunity if he injected himself into a suit in Chicago by writing a... Why not?
The answer is no, and I think we brought it up in our...
Why?
In response, they cited Cooney, the case of Cooney,
why
I believe.
Why is the answer no?
Because they are not in the same office.
No, they are. They both work for the Justice Department. That's the same office.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm thinking of the state's attorney's office, which is...
No, no. I'm talking about a federal assistant U.S. attorney. They're all employees of the Justice Department.
But the issue is if they're all in the U.S. attorney's office, then yes, that immunity would apply for anything related to a particular criminal defendant's trial and his claim that implicates a trial-related function.
In the United States, if it's part of the Justice Department.
And Van de Kamp, I think, does not draw a temporal or sort of geographical line.
But it's
line.
Beginning to sound preposterous.
I'm not sure how it sounds.
Here you have a guy in Arizona. He's absolutely no business with anything to do in New York. But he has an enemy, in Chicago. He's an enemy in Chicago. So he sends some fraudulent evidence to a prosecutor in Chicago. And you're saying he has absolute immunity because, after all, it's one Justice Department and they're all prosecutors, so anything they do, absolute immunity.
I would only
that seems like an extreme position.
And as you've set up the hypothetical, it would be, Your Honor. But as I'm trying to imagine the practical scenario where that would happen would be that prosecutor in the Arizona office would have some, for some reason, obviously has some knowledge of what the prosecution in the Chicago office is.
Sure, it's his enemy. It's his enemy. His enemy is being prosecuted in Chicago. He hates him. Personal enemy. He stole his wife, something like that. So he sends some fraudulent, material to Chicago. And which helps to nail this person.
Let me just see if I'm clear about your hypothetical. Would that be prior to any prosecution existing? Because then I think that does take us into the area of Buckley, the Supreme Court's decision in Buckley.
This person's being prosecuted in Chicago, and this fellow in Arizona reads the newspaper and says, wow, my enemy, they have him. I'm going to make sure he's nailed, because I'm going to send some anonymous, cleverly forged documents to the prosecutor, which will help to nail him.
Well, I think we're in what they discussed in Imbler. Prosecutorial immunity might apply, but there are other sanctions that are available, including criminal, for that kind of conduct.
So that's all right. So that's your position. Immunity applies. All right. Glad to hear it.
Go ahead.
Of course, yeah.
My time is expired, so
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Judge Posner's allowing me to go forward for just a question.
Sure.
Take a large office like the one you belong to, L.A. or...
Which I believe is the second largest.
Where we're talking in the multiples of 100.
Right.
If you have, would you allow any distinction between, let's say, an assistant who spent 10 years in the civil division, in tax collection, perhaps, and he was the individual that Judge Posner has posited in this large office. Would you want the reach to go that far? This person has never seen, looked at a grand jury transcript or whatever, clearly carries the authority of the assistant state's attorney, but has never taken a confession, anything like that. Could we not at least focus a little bit on unit in your, or do you say, or do you think the immunity just has to attend an entire office? And when I speak of an office, I'm talking one your size.
That's a more difficult question, Your Honor, and I don't think we need to reach that in this case particularly. But the question, we have to look at the underlying facts of what the claim is that's being raised. For instance, does that assistant that's in civil have some sort of Brady material that should have gotten to the criminal defendant in the underlying trial? I think under Vandekamp, the answer is yes, immunity would apply.
Let's even take the example of Judge Posner, where it's sort of the creation of false evidence.
Well, and that's where I think the discussion of Buckley that then does come into play when you're talking about whether you are acting in a prosecutorial capacity or not. And that seems to be more directly related to the question of whether the prosecution has actually begun or not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Garcia and Mr. Goodman.